You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this week's Lyric Feature, the third episode in our series, Feather and Flock, in which ecologist Anya Murray and folk musician Brian McLynn turn their attention to our native wild birds. This week, it's lapwing.
Welcome to Feather and Flock, a series about some of Ireland's most charismatic birds. I'm Anya Murray. I'm an ecologist and a writer. I love being out where wild things are, watching, listening, and doing my best to tune in to the intriguing goings-on in the natural world.
And I'm Brian McLynn. I'm a musician and songwriter, mostly with my band Ye Vagabonds. And I'm also a bit obsessed with the natural world and all the things that live around us. In each episode, Anya and I weave together ecology and conservation with folklore and music to create an audio portrait of a species.
Today, we're delving into the lives of lapwing, one of the most beautiful and distinctive birds of Irish farmland. Lapwing are also known by many as green plovers, because of their stunning, iridescent, green and purple-tinged plumage. Others call them peewit because of their calls.
As well as being colourful and distinctive-looking, the sounds that lapwing make are quite peculiar. Their otherworldly calls have been a great inspiration for the music that I've made for this episode in collaboration with ambient musician Gareth Quinn Redmond.
These birds have been so beloved over the centuries that they've even been given the accolade of Ireland's national bird. But lapwing have been finding it harder and harder to survive and reproduce. Such is the rapid rate of transformation across Irish landscapes. Now their population is at an all-time low. But there are inspirational conservation efforts afoot. And to find out about the many ways that people are working hard to protect this iconic bird, Brian and I have travelled to meet a few of the folks who've been looking after lapwing breeding habitats, beginning in some wet, offaly fields, then travelling up to the coastal plains of West Donegal, and back to meet with a future-thinking farmer in County Kildare. Lapwing breed on open ground, in big farmland fields, in open boggy places, on coastal pastures, and even among planted crops. They also avoid breeding anywhere near trees, as they need a good clear sightline so they can see predators coming, which is necessary when you're a ground nesting bird. Another thing they need for rearing their young is wet, muddy patches. But to find out more about lapwing breeding habitats, Brian and I set out one drizzly summer morning to County Offaly, where we had arranged to meet with Ricky Whelan. Ricky is host of Birdwatch Ireland's In Your Nature podcast and is also now biodiversity officer with Offaly County Council. He has been working with lapwing in the Midlands for many years, and he was the perfect person to bring us to see a field full of lapwing with their young. It's absolutely lashing rain, so we're hiding out in the car. Would you say we're kind of using the car as a hide, Ricky?
It's a mobile hide. It's perfect. It's working perfectly, actually. We can see piles from here.
And we're looking over a whole field full of lapwing.
We are. We're in this sort of soggy Midlands, very close to Loch Bora, on one of the reclaimed patches that is now agricultural land that would have been a cutaway bog at one point, but the lapwing don't seem to know or care because they're here in their numbers, and they're really lovely to see, really.
Where are those binoculars? How many birds can you see there, Ricky?
On a very quick scan, there's easily 130 birds there.
In this one field?
In this one field in the breeding season, and there's somewhere between 500 and 600 pairs of lapwing breeding in this country as we speak. So that's how low we've gone. and we're looking at 130. So they're doing really well here. There is something good is happening in this part of the world.
Lapwing have charismatic courting rituals. Each spring, males sing their strange and otherworldly calls and perform wonderfully acrobatic aerial displays, twirling as they fly and looping through the air on their long lapping wings. All this to show the lady lapwings how fit and agile they are, to demonstrate what a great choice of mate they would make. When the eggs are being laid, normally in May, lapwing make a subtle scrape in the ground in lieu of a proper nest. I've stood over a clutch of lapwing eggs, peering intently at the spot where my colleagues were pointing. And still I struggled to see the brown mottled eggs that blended so well with the brown soggy soil and tufty sedges. The chicks that hatch are also cleverly disguised. Their feathers are an uncanny imitation of the texture of moss and mud, cryptic plumage that has evolved to keep these vulnerable little creatures from being seen by predators, as long as they keep quiet.
They've got low vegetation where they can make this little scrape of a nest, which is basically a little hollow. They line it with a little bit of grass, but nothing to talk about. It's just a tiny little scrape in the earth.
And just a few bits of grass to line it?
Yeah, sometimes nothing at all. They're a really impressive bird in that they have this funny evolutionary trait, the plovers and the lapwing. They're precocial, which means when they hatch, they're very, very well advanced, and within a few hours, they're already up and feeding themselves. And if you compare that to the likes of a blue tit or a little robin chick that everyone will be familiar with, they're bald and dumb and helpless for at least 3 or 4 weeks before they can do anything, never mind feed themselves. So precocial birds get up and going and feed themselves within hours, which is just amazing. But it's very much a requirement because they're ground nesting birds. So their nest is on the ground, just a little bare scrape. And the nest for a bird is essentially the most dangerous place you can be because you're a sitting duck. So as soon as they can get up and out of there and away from the hooded crows, from the foxes, from even hedgehogs might nobble you if you're a little chick in a nest, a ground nesting bird. So it's really, really, it's touch and go for them.
What are they doing, poking around among the grass there?
It's lashing rain and the worms are close to the surface, and one of their main dietary items is worms. So they're having a good old time, and the parents are teaching the juveniles how to feed and how to go about their business. They just glean littles for mosquitoes and flies and stuff from the water surface, from pools. So that's why you hear people going on about sort of wet grassland and all that sort of stuff when we talk about ground nesting birds like curlew and redshank and snipe and lapwing. When my granddad or that generation were farming, like grass was cut once a year. It was a hay cut taken at the end of the year. So all the seed had dropped by then, which meant the birds had something to eat during the winter and all that sort of stuff. And then the animals got the hay. And then the field was full of insects all summer long. So it was absolutely perfect cycle for biodiversity. But now, because we rely so much on nitrogen and grass and to get all the meat and milk and all that we need, we hammer the ground with nitrogen to make the grass grow quicker to get 4 or 5 cuts of silage. But if you're a ground nesting bird and there's a huge machine rolling over the top of your nest once every couple of weeks, it's not going to sort of, just doesn't add up. Even draining land, even forestry now, it fragments that landscape, which is troublesome for them, yeah.
In the 1970s, lapwing were declared to be the national bird of Ireland at a time when they were abundant across the country. But since the 1980s, lapwing were pushed out of breeding areas because land use changed so drastically, from hay to silage, and a whole lot of land drainage too. Now, far from being celebrated as the national bird of Ireland, few people have ever seen a lapwing, nor even know what they look like.
Yeah, so they're a couple of 100 feet away from us now. To the naked eye, they look essentially black and white. When they fly, they look even more sort of pied. But when you look at them with the binoculars, they have a green sheen, lovely dark green iridescent sheen on top, which is remarkable, really. It's really, really beautiful colour, but you need it in very strong, good sunlight and close-up view, really, through optics, through your binoculars there, to really get a measure of that. But yeah, no, they are green. And I mean, green plover is their traditional name for them. I mean, people that don't call them lapwing always call them green plover or peewits. And peewits is based on their call, which we'll probably hear now.
Peewits.
Because lapwing have always been plentiful across Irish farmland fields, there's a wealth of linguistic and folk associations with these characterful birds, particularly in the Irish language. To find out more about the pilobean in our language and songs, I met with Aoife Ní Ghlin, director of Láirionad na Gaeilge at NUI Maynooth, who shared some quirky details about the word pilobean, as well as an old Irish song she found and sang for us. Apart from her expertise in linguistics and songs, Aoife also happens to be my sister, and I was delighted to join her on the song Pilobean na Guach.
So the word pilobean in Irish has a number of meanings. It means, first of all, the bird, the lapwing, or also maybe the plover. But it also has another metaphorical meaning. It's kind of a euphemism for male anatomy. And there aren't that many songs that I've come across anyway that mention the pilobean, but I came across this nice little song in the Clashgadal song sheets. These are songs that were collected, I think, around the 1930s, and they've been digitised by the Irish Traditional Music Archive, so they're available online, which is a great resource. And I've come across this nice little song, Pilobean na Guach, which is translates as the lapwing or pilobean of the cuckoos, which is an interesting thing that we've brought the two birds there together in the title of this song. And I suppose it's kind of a light-hearted love song. There's the classic bit of unrequited love. We've got a mention of a dowry, which you often have in these love songs. The song that begins by saying, "It's a great pity that I'm not a pilobean, rolling in the heather with my love and whispering sweet nothings to her and, you know, making kind of clever conversation and maybe telling her a few lies as well." So it's obviously, it was a man who speaking in this song. And he says, "And God bless the one who can manage to marry a woman without a penny of dowry." So, and then he talks about, in the next verse, he talks about, you know, kind of, I suppose, waiting. He's impatient, maybe. And as he awaits this marriage, his chance to go down on one knee in front of Father O'Brien. And then that's, we get the references there to the pilobean, but then, and I suppose maybe it's the kind of the metaphorical meaning that's coming through in some of the kind of the sexual references in the first verse, particularly of the song. But then the song kind of takes a bit of a turn in the third verse, and in a way I think we get the sense of the other meaning of the word pilobean. This third verse reminds me a little bit of the songs associated with the cuckoo, because this cuckoo obviously is the herald of summer and spring, and the cuckoo brings us great hope. And the same kind of sentiment is captured in the third verse of this song in relation to the pilobean. It says, you know, 100 welcomes to the festival of breed who gives us courage, you know, tells us that spring is on the way. 100 welcomes to St. Patrick's Day, and 100 welcomes to Pilobean na Guach, pilobean of the cuckoos. So we get the two birds brought together there. You know, I don't know if it's really a reference to the cuckoo itself. Sometimes na Guach of the cuckoos is used as a kind of a term of endearment. We hear that in the song Mali na Guach ní Chulainn. So I don't know, maybe it's just a term of endearment that the cuckoos brought in. Or maybe it's, maybe implying in some way that this pilobean is a bit of a rascal himself. There could be a bit of that in, because the cuckoo's known for that. So maybe that's it. But either way, the two of them here are there to herald in and to welcome in the summer and the spring. I suppose the classic unrequited love in Irish is full of sorrow and misery and pain. So it's nice to have one where, you know, he's not taking things too seriously, and there's a bit of hope, there's a note of hope and courage at the end of it as we welcome in the spring.
Oh, it's time.
Lapwing are not especially demanding in their needs. They have adapted to lots of different habitat types. But we have changed their habitat so much in recent times that they just aren't able to successfully feed or protect their chicks. Later in the episode, we will visit a couple of places where people are going to great lengths to make sure lapwing have safe places to breed. Conservation projects that are working well.
The names, customs, traditional beliefs and stories that we associate with the lapwing can give us some insight into how much of a value is placed on them in the past. Folklore helps to paint a picture of the country back when lapwing were abundant and found in every townland in Ireland. So, on a windy spring morning, I met with Rianach Iogan, Professor Emeritus of Folklore and former Director of the National Folklore Collection in UCD, to find out more about the pinnibee in Irish folklore.
The Irish word pinnibeen comes to light throughout the folklore tradition, through in English as well as in Irish. Pinnibeen can mean anything small, like a small egg or a barnacle or a tiny person or a thing. And it's also used to name or to christen maybe a small animal. I encountered one account where a pet cow or calf was called pinnibeen because she was small. In place names, pinnibeen occurs as well. It seems to be in field names of Gari na Bilibeen, Gurt na Bilibeen, which was frequented by lapwing. The word fadog is used a great deal for the lapwing as well. If we look at the website loganam.ie, which is a wonderful resource for place names, we find, for example, Mon na Vadog, bogland of the plover, Lis na Vadog, Groig na Vadog, the cluster or hamlet, Bar na Vadog, the top, Clon na Vadog, the meadow, Crook na Vadog, Glan na Vadog, the glen of the plover, Ord na Vadog, the height, and Shaskan na Vadog, or the fen. And these are only some of the place names. So I think it indicates how common a bird it was in particular areas and that it was associated with places.
The name Fadog, which means whistle, is used interchangeably in Irish for the lapwing as well as for the plover. Similar to how the lapwing is often called the green plover in English too. The pinnibeen is well and truly part of the Irish language. There's even a phrase directly related to the lapwing's deceptive behaviour.
In folk tradition, the plover is associated very much with pride, deceit and potential for misfortune. There are sayings in Irish, for example, a sheshona and Philippine on a nyada gahain, and that implies that the pinnibeen or the plover is distracting attention from his nest. If he sees danger coming and has eggs in the nest, he flies away from the nest, screeching loudly, and pretends that he has a broken wing, and that will distract the enemy from approaching. So the phrase in Irish is also called Clasan Philibean, or the trick of the Philibean, or the plover. And it's used very often to describe somebody who might be evading an issue, or somebody who might be drawing in a red herring. In terms of folk tradition as well, we have descriptions of birds being caught or trapped, and the actual trap is described. One account tells us that snares are made for wild birds like the curlew, the lapwing and the snipe out of plaited horsehair and made into a gashk and set around a waterhole, and the birds are caught then by the head or by the feet. Sometimes eggs or birds' eggs are seen to cure particular illnesses or diseases. And in the case of the Philibean, we're told that there's supposed to be a great cure for pneumonia. And just sometimes to spot the bird would be enough to cause a cure, to bring about a cure. People used to eat some of these birds as well, and the plover was sometimes eaten, and in places it was regarded as a delicacy. When the rule of not eating meat on Fridays, I think that these birds were eaten and regarded as fish other than meat, because they almost tasted like fish, probably.
Up until the last century, lapwing were so widely eaten in Ireland and across Europe that in the 1940s they were netted and sold for sixpence apiece. In France, Greece, Italy and Spain, millions were shot each year until the 1980s, when conservation concerns began to kick in. Before the word folklore was invented, people had belief systems to rely on for their safety, health and security, often based on plants, animals and birds. It seems like the lapwing were a big part of that belief system in Ireland, predicting the weather, warning us of imminent dangers and curing illnesses. People used to trust the lapwing and placed a huge value on them.
There are some tales and legends associated with the Philibean, and not just in Ireland, but in international folklore as well. We're told that the lapwing is the departed spirit, and they still haunt the earth because of something that troubles them. And also there are beliefs associated with the sound of the Philibean's cry, the lapwing's cry, which is quite lonesome and high-pitched. In earlier Irish tradition, the cry of the plover is very, very significant as an omen of approaching danger and as a warning. In the Fíneacht, Diarmaid was warned of the danger of possibly falling into an enchanted sleep for thousands of years. And so Diarmaid wore a collar that had 12 sharp spikes on it. And when he heard the cry of the plover and started to fall asleep, his head lolled over onto the spikes, and that kept him awake. So he was then able to reach the plover and take the egg. And the plover stopped singing and the spell was broken.
Hearing what Rianach had to say, it's clear to me that lapwing were important in people's imaginations, in the language and in our psyches, but also in the landscape right across this country. Sometimes I wonder if folk beliefs to do with our wildlife and ecology existed in order to maintain a balanced relationship between people and nature. And maybe if we had held on to more of these values, populations of wildlife like lapwing wouldn't be so at risk right now.
Breeding lapwing are now endangered in Ireland. This means that enormous efforts are needed to safeguard the places where they're breeding and to help them regain lost ground too. Brian and I went to visit a project in Donegal where careful habitat management is helping resident lapwing populations. We were shown around by Dr. Anita Donaghy, Assistant Head of Conservation with Birdwatch Ireland, and she brought us to Derry Beg in Gweedore in West Donegal.
This is Machair, a habitat known as Machair that we're standing in now, which is sandy grassland, effectively, a very rare habitat, actually, in global terms, and very species-rich. It's one of the very important things about the openness of this landscape is the fact that there's very few trees, and that's actually one of the things that breeding waders like.
So if they need short grass, like you're saying, does that mean that maybe they'll actually do well in areas that are a little bit grazed?
Grazing is one of the important things, you know, so very often you'll find them in grazed habitats.
Machair is a very special type of habitat, found only on sandy ground in coastal areas, where a mosaic of flower-filled plains mingle with open, marshy areas. Machair is a wonderland for wildflowers and wild bees, butterflies and breeding waders like lapwing, snipe and redshank. And you say that they're lapwing are breeding here on this kind of open Machair habitat. What other kind of habitats do they breed in? Because they would have been once common all over Ireland, right?
Yeah, they would have had a much wider distribution. A lapwing would be found in damp, rushy pastures, in peat bogs, in cereal fields. You know, they can be found in quite dry habitats too. So even slightly improved grassland as well, you know, if all the conditions are right, you know, you will find lapwing breeding there as well, you know.
Sounds like they're kind of quite adaptable, that they can breed in so many different habitat types. What has happened now, though, that their population is diminished so drastically over the last 20 or 30 years?
It's mostly related to predation. So that's predation of nests and chicks as well. You know, there would have been drainage of wetlands, agricultural improvement, loss of peat bogs. All of these things would have caused loss of their habitat. So their habitats became smaller and more fragmented. And at the same time, generalist predators such as crows and foxes were increasing in the landscape.
All of this habitat loss and fragmentation has meant that lapwing are no longer able to breed successfully across their former range.
The range decline of lapwing has been in the region of about 90% since the first atlas, which was in the 1970s, so huge declines.
90% decline in their range from the 1970s up to now, the 2020s.
And the MPWS estimate that there's about 500 pairs left, you know, so there was thousands of pairs, you know, of lapwing breeding in Ireland.
And you've spent a decade or more now doing lapwing conservation projects by doing things like what we can see here, this predator-proof fencing to protect their breeding areas. When did you start doing the conservation programme?
So we started putting up these predator-proof fences in about 2005. And that was in the Shannon Callows, on an island called Inishee in the Shannon Callows. And we then put in a second one at our reserve, Termancara, in West Mayo. We've since put in five fences here in Donegal. So effectively what they are the physical barriers around the breeding colonies to protect the nests and chicks from foxes and mink, you know, during the breeding season. These fences work by allowing the nest to survive to hatching, allowing then the chicks to survive the first few weeks of life. You know, and every week that the chick survives, it gets stronger and its chances of surviving to fledging increase. So this is really giving the chicks a chance to reach that critical fledging stage.
To sustain the existing population, each pair of breeding lapwing need to fledge one chick per year. It might not sound like much, but even this level of breeding success is really hard to achieve.
I mean, it's really like a population on life support, isn't it? That you have to go to these lengths of controlling the predators and putting up the fencing.
Yeah, it's absolutely drastic. And if these fences hadn't been here, you know, potentially there would have been very few lapwing left in Donegal, for example.
And what would be a good longer-term prospect for lapwing?
Well, I mean, the ultimate aim would be to restore landscapes to such an extent that the birds are able to sustain productivity without, you know, these kind of drastic measures. But that's a huge challenge. So for the foreseeable future, I can't see a time when these populations are going to be self-sustaining. They're still going to need interventions, serious interventions like this, you know, for many years to come.
And if we don't have those serious interventions, lapwing will more than likely go extinct in the next decade or two.
Yeah, in the next couple of decades, yeah. Yeah.
Lapwing, along with other endangered breeding waders, need all the help we can possibly give them. But these kind of interventions are expensive. It's welcome news, then, that a new fund has been established by government to help with the protection and conservation of breeding waders, because lapwing need a whole pile more projects to maintain a viable breeding population. There is hope yet for this species. Get a sense of some of the smaller projects that are popping up around the country. Brian and I went to meet a Kildare beef farmer, Anthony Mooney, who's been going to great lengths for wildlife and is now hoping to entice lapwing to breed on his farm. As we arrived in the farmyard, Anthony was keen to show us some of the things he's been doing for nature on his farm.
The door's here. The doors are made a long, long time. They're made maybe 25 years. You see the gap on top of the door?
Oh, yes, okay.
Let the swallows in.
The gap on top of the door is specifically to let the swallows in and out of the sheds.
Specifically to let the swallows in.
Oh, there they are.
Yeah, there they are. Amazing. The dirt will all come down in one place. You can leave a piece of plastic or you can leave a bucket under the nest, collect the dirt. People often say we don't want the dirt in the shed. Look, simple solution. Not terribly complicated, yeah. Swift boxes.
Oh, fantastic.
So it works well. It really works well. There were no swifts here up to about 5 years ago. And I began to hear that people were trying to help swifts and they were putting up boxes. That's a speaker there, and we have a call in the house. I played it for a year one and two, and it brought the swifts in. And they're nesting there every year. But it's great fun to watch it. It's look, that's another simple thing a person can do if somebody wants to help birds. Next thing I was asked, would I be interested in taking in young leverets that didn't have a home to go to?
No.
So we started it here about 4 or 5 years ago. We get a couple of hares a year, a couple of young leverets a year, and it seems to work very well. Usually where people just see a young leveret that's lost, it often happens on a building site where ground would be disturbed, and they ring some of the wildlife rescue crowds. So a leveret comes in here, and it has as long as it wants to gather its wits and to work out things. And I think they're great. I think they listen an awful lot to birds. They know by the tone of a bird song whether that bird is happy or whether that bird is afraid of something. I think they work it all out. They're picking up the information they need to know. Is it safe to be out here? Is it not? And they do. You know, they seem to do very well. They just seem to do very well. It's a great source of information on wildlife. If you don't have hares on a habitat in the first case, you're not going to learn anything about them. But if you have them close at hand, you'll start learning about them and you'll build up information and knowledge on them, and you're in a better position to help them. So... Seems to work well.
So, Anthony, you're not just farming swifts and swallows and hares, though. What else have you got in the land here?
Well, look, it's all on-farm entertainment. That's the way people that are interested in wildlife are interested in the environment use that term, on-farm entertainment.
I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, well, that's the way it is, you know. We finish cattle on the farm for beef and this keep suckler cows, small herd of suckler cows. It's an all-grass farm. It's a wet farm. Wet, heavy clay, wet kind of farm. It's part of the Liffey Valley.
I mean, the birdsong here is amazing. We're mid-morning in April, and it's just a cacophony of birdsong.
One, two, three, four swallows, five swallows, six swallows. There you are. That's the best count now in a while. Do you hear swallow song? I hear the little twitter there. Yeah? We're going this way, come on. There's the farm now, just being naturally sticky, heavy and wet. Yeah. That's the sign there. It
is. This field actually has a bit of a pond over the far end. Is that deliberate or is
that's
that...
That's deliberate. It's the lowest place on the farm. The lowest field on the farm, I was inclined to be wet and heavy, and a lot of trouble went into draining it a long time ago. I think around the 1840s or 50s, Carton House, which was the home of the Duke of Leinster, would have sponsored drainage all around the area here to improve agricultural production. And then, I'd say in the 50s and 60s, modern-day drainage came into being then.
And the pond is here despite all of that historic drainage?
Well, despite the best efforts of previous generations, there was a shift in thinking and in approach, and it was decided that we would just make a wet area out of it for various reasons, make a wet area out of it and see what happens.
And why? How did you take that notion that you want this field to be wet when everybody else is draining off
fields?
Okay,
everybody, yeah, and it goes on. It's still going on today. It's going on today all around this particle there. You know, there's drainage going on. There's lovely, lovely natural sites being converted into more productive habitats. But, it was always, look, wildlife, I suppose, was always interesting to me. And if you're interested in wildlife, you're going to take a look at the habitats they prefer. And around here, wetland habitats would have been very plentiful, I'd say, up to the 70s, up to the 1970s, 1980s. And if you look at some of the older maps in the area, it's very evident that, you know, there were wetlands all around the area here. The unfortunate thing is, I think, we just don't consider the value of those sites and what was using them. We had a purpose in mind and we went ahead and fulfilled that purpose, but we didn't consider what wildlife was there. And just as a consequence then, an awful lot of things vanished. So it's amazing to think that there were curlews nesting within a short distance of where we're standing. I remember them. I remember them nesting here. That would have been in the 70s. Up to 10 years ago, lapwing were still trying very bravely and very boldly in this area here. I saw them on till fields. I saw them on wet grassland. But with intensification and very fast agricultural work, very fast times in the spring, people don't have time to consider them, and I think the real problem is they don't place a value or see a value in them. How do you get people to think differently? How do you get them to change their approach? I don't know. You can only appeal to their better natures. Seeing how fast these birds are disappearing, they really are disappearing at a rapid pace, we decided to give this a go. And what was done was, there was a main drain coming down the middle of the field that would have been put in, I'd say, in the late 60s, 70s. We found the main drain and we blocked it.
Did you? So you actually blocked the drain in this big grassy field?
And I got a contractor in with a digger. Now, and I'll never forget his reaction. You want me to what? You want me to block the main pipe? You want me to wet the field? A good field? I'm not doing it. And that's what he genuinely said, he wouldn't do it. He said if word got around among farmers around here that I was doing work like that, I'd lose work.
Anthony managed at last to get another digger driver in, and the field drains got broken up. And this floodplain reverted to its natural wet state. He got a grant to do this from an initiative called Farming for Nature Programme that covered the cost of the digger for a few days. What we saw was a big wet area right in the middle of the field, surrounded by an electric fence and brimming with life.
And I can see that there's lots of kind of wet, pondy areas and muddy areas. And that's all the kind of things that lapwing really like to feed their young.
I saw a lapwing here over the winter. I came out a couple of nights at 12 o'clock and there was a good few birds here. There could be 20 to 30 birds here. A lot of them were mallard. There were teal, there were widgeon, there were snipe. I saw woodcock circling around, but I came out here one night and there was a lapwing there at that pole. The specific target for here is lapwing. There's only, in the area here, there's only one small flock of them left, and they're getting smaller each spring. So the hope is to attract them in. So you'd ask yourself, what do a lapwing like? Lapwing like that. There is muddy ground, wet ground, part of it raised. You see the raised parts there, part of it raised, and that raised ground will hold on to worms all the time, and invertebrates, which is what lapwing eat.
They can access the soil.
They can access the soil. Lapwings are sight faithful. Apparently lapwing aren't. Apparently lapwing will go around and look. If a site is not working for them for a few years, they'll go and look for somewhere else. So that's the hope here. They just might see this.
It was so inspiring to see what Anthony's doing on his land. His approach to restoring habitats uses both common sense and radical thinking, as well as a good sense of humour. We could learn an awful lot from farmers like Anthony. While recording soundscapes for this programme, I contacted Jason Monaghan, conservation ranger with the NPWS at Kuldrass Breeding Wader Project in Kilcoole, County Wicklow. Jason invited me to join him one fresh sunny day in late April, and I was delighted to get the chance to access such a precious, highly protected habitat. Jason told me that he only enters this reserve during the nesting season when he really needs to, as any disturbance at all stresses out the lapwing and makes it more likely that predators will find their nests. So armed with my microphones and binoculars, I gingerly followed Jason's exact footsteps through the wetlands towards the area where the lapwing nest. Jason left me off in one part of the field to record while he continued into the nesting site. At this stage, I'd been learning about these birds for a year, hearing so much about efforts to save them and their demise in recent decades. And honestly, I had started to lose hope for the lapwing. I longed for that peewit call I was so familiar with hearing, and to see the changing colours of lapwing flocks flying around the boggy ends of fields again. Amidst all the uncertainty for the lapwing, here I was in a wet field in Wicklow, surrounded by their iridescent wings and their piping song. In my ears was a stunning and hopeful soundscape. Jason called me over to the edge of one of the pools. Hiding in the grass was a tiny mottled brown lapwing chick who ran quickly across the mud to join its sibling in their tiny little scrape of grass nest. So vulnerable and so inspiring to see, this lively little chick was the living proof that conservation work pays off. Jason told me that when he first started working at that site 7 years ago, there were only 2 pairs of lapwing left there. Now, there are 70 pairs of lapwing, and the highly endangered redshank have also returned this year for the first time. If projects like this one are supported, maybe there is some hope for these birds after all.
is a health to my bilibeen, not the last of the mongrel. Caught in the boggy ground, it made me smile to think that he'd come back around. So take down the best bottle and pass the glass around. Here's a health to my Billy, not the last of them on the ground. So take down the best bottle and pass the glass around. Here's a health to my Billy, not the last of them on the ground.
Lapwing have been in Ireland longer than people have. They're strange coal, part of the weft of Irish soundscapes. Their shimmering green feathers and characterful crest have endeared people to them for eons. And lapwing have long been the crowning glory of wet grasslands, marshy places and macaire habitats. A certain harmony once existed when lapwing, curlew, redshank and snipe found a way to live well among the cattle and the crops. But now, in these troubling times of ecosystem collapse, when the warp and weft of so much of the natural world is unfraying, we must do all we can to strike a better balance, to protect what remains of wild species, and in nourishing acts of hope to restore enough wet grasslands that the diversity of wild flowers, wild bees, butterflies and birds that they sustain might still be part of the heritage that we hand down to the next generation.
As is the case for the entire biodiversity crisis, it can be difficult to see anything other than the dangers facing our ecosystems. But we must remain absolutely focused on the safe path through. If we can support conservation specialists like Jason, Ricky and Anita, as well as farmers like Anthony Mooney, to do the work that needs to be done, then the lapwing and the rest of our insects, plants and creatures might stand a chance to face off this crisis.
Thank you.
Lapwing, the third programme in that series, Feather and Flock, was presented by Anya Murray and Brian McLean. The score was composed by Gareth Quinn Redmond. It was inspired by the Lapwing's otherworldly call, and it was performed on electronics and synthesizers alongside Brian McLean on guitar and paintbrush. Aoife Ní Ghlin sang Pilibín na Guach, accompanying herself on Shruti Box, along with Brian on guitar, fiddle, and harmonium. The Pilibín was written and performed by Ye Vagabonds, Brian and Dermot McLean, for this episode. We also heard two other tunes written and performed by Brian McLean, Class on Philibín and On Scalthorn. All music was recorded and mixed by Brian and Gareth Quinn Redmond. All soundscapes and bird sounds were recorded in the field by Brian McLean and Sean Ronayne of Irish Wildlife Sounds. And a special thank you also to Jason Monaghan and Barry O'Donoghue of the National Parks and Wildlife Service for their help in the making of this programme. Feather and Flock is produced by Anya Murray, who has written a blog about the making of the programmes, which you can find on the culture pages of the RTE website.
This week's lyric feature was funded by the Broadcasting Authority of Ireland from the television licence fee. The producer for Lyric FM was Owen O'Kelly.
The first three episodes of the series are all available from the RTE radio player, from the lyric feature webpage, and from all the other platforms where you might expect to find them. The Feather and Flock series will return in the autumn with three more episodes when Anya and Brian fix their attention on the skylark, the tern and the eagle. On next week's lyric feature, Liz Nolan will be telling the story of Maria Callas. Maria La Callas is on Sunday at 6 p.m.